I am Dr. Rapp, and this is Appreciating Shakespeare, Series 2, Podcast X, Selected Sonnets, Numbers 1 through 65. In the podcast of Chapter 11 in Series 1, I discuss the general characteristics of Shakespeare's 154 sonnets. What follows now are notes on selected individual sonnets, ending today with Sonnet 65. After a few words about the first group of 17 sonnets, I will read each selected sonnet, then discuss its particulars, and then read it again. Sonnets 1 through 17. The first 17 sonnets in the sequence exhort the young man to whom the poems are dedicated to marry and beget children as a way of preserving his virtues and his beauty, which must inevitably pass away in time. Sonnet 15 prefigures a theme to which Shakespeare will return in later sonnets, starting with Sonnet 18, immortalizing the beloved in poetry. But Sonnet 15 is paired with Sonnet 16, which again urges the young man to marry. Some have thought that Shakespeare was commissioned to write these poems by the young man's mother in an effort to get her son to marry and to carry on the family line. They argue that Shakespeare began by fulfilling his commission, but then came to know and love the young man in himself, and continued writing sonnets to convey his unfolding experience of love as the friendship developed. This is speculation. The facts are not known. Sonnet 18. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature's changing course, untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest. Nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. The first line of the sonnet, "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?" is a yes or no question, to which the rest of the poem answers both yes and no. It can do so because of the double sense of the word compare. Shall I make a comparison of you to a summer's day? Yes, the rest of the poem makes that comparison. Do you bear comparison with a summer's day in the sense of being equal to it? No, because thou art more lovely and more temperate, line 2. The next 6 lines list the potentially intemperate qualities of a summer's day. The season of summer days may be late in arriving or early in departing, lines 3 and 4. Any given summer's day may be too hot or too cloudy, lines 5 and 6. And every summer's day, like every form of beauty, declines with time, lines 7 and 8. The volta, or turning point, comes at the beginning of the third quatrain, with the word but, line 9, but thy eternal summer shall not fade. The proclamation that the beloved's beauty, by contrast with the summer's day, is eternal, surviving even death. Line 12, when in eternal lines to time thou growest, makes a play on words distinguishing between temporal lines, the wrinkles that in time ruin beauty, and eternal lines, the lasting lines of verse. The couplet concludes the poem with the assertion that this, that is, the poem itself, will survive in its unchanging form so long as there are human readers of poems. The beloved is immortalized by living on within the lines of the poem. This power of poetry to bestow immortality on the poet and on his subject is an ancient theme, appearing in Horace, Odes, Book 3, Poem 30, Lines 1 through 5, and Ovid, Metamorphoses, Book 15, lines 871 to 879, and Amores, Book 1, Elegies 10 and 15. And in many Renaissance poets, including Spenser, Complaints, The Ruins of Time, lines 253 to 259, lines 358 to 364, lines 400 to 406. Shakespeare partly depends upon the awareness of that tradition for his effects in the sonnets. He is also, of course, aware that the better the poem, the likelier it is to survive through time. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe, or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. Sonnet 20. A woman's face with nature's own hand painted hast thou, the master, mistress of my passion. A woman's gentle heart, but not acquainted with shifting change, as is false women's fashion. An eye more bright than theirs, less false in rolling, gilding the object whereupon it gazeth. A man in hue, all hues in his controlling, which steals men's eyes and women's souls amazeth. And for a woman wert thou first created, till nature, as she wrought thee, fell a-doting, and, by addition, me of thee defeated, by adding one thing to my purpose, nothing. But since she pricked thee out for women's pleasure, mine be thy love, and thy love's use their treasure. This is the one sonnet in which sexual, as opposed to romantic, attraction to the young man is hinted at, and in it the possibility of sexual satisfaction with the man is denied. The sonnet figures the beloved friend as originally intended by nature to be a woman because of his qualities, a beautiful face, but painted so by nature herself rather than with the cosmetics used by women, a heart that is gentle, implying both gentleness and gentility, but not fickle and inconstant, as women, governed by the moon, or perhaps only false women, were in general thought to be. A bright eye, from which light beams were thought to emanate, sight arising from the reflection of those beams back to the eye. A manly combination of temperament and form that, however, compels the gaze of men and amazes the souls of women. As G. Blakemore Evans writes, in Neoplatonic terms, the eyes were thought of as the windows of the soul. Men, therefore, may be thought of as viewing the youth intellectually, women emotionally. In keeping with the feminine qualities of the young man, Sonnet 20, says Evans, quote, is the only one of Shakespeare's sonnets to use feminine rhyme throughout. Unquote. This is true, though Sonnet 87 has feminine rhymes in all but two of its lines. I discussed masculine and feminine endings in Session 2 of Chapter 4 on Shakespeare's Language in Series 1. However, as nature was making this would-be female, she fell in love with her creation, and, being female herself, added one thing to turn him into a male. The word thing is common in Shakespeare as a euphemism for both the male and the female genitalia, and the implication is confirmed in the couplet with the pun, pricked thee out, a triple pun, meaning chosen you, decorated you, and added a penis to your anatomy. That one thing, however, added for the pleasure of women, is to my purpose nothing. In other words, having that thing, the beloved cannot fulfill the speaker's erotic purpose. Hence the addition of it, turning the intended woman into a man, me of thee defeated, deprived me of the ability to enact the erotic relation with you that might have been had you been a woman as nature originally intended. The added thing to the speaker is no thing, because it is not a woman's thing. Nothing was probably pronounced like noting, as in Much Ado About Nothing. If so, the meaning of the secondary sense may be either pointing toward, the beloved's added thing cannot be the lover's objective because it itself points elsewhere, or stigmatizing, branding with disgrace. The lover's erotic purpose would be discredited if directed toward the beloved, given nature's addition to his anatomy. The couplet's conclusion employs the word use in three senses. A. Interest or increase on an investment of capital. B. Sexual intercourse in general, and specifically use of the penis in sex. And C. Increase, in the sense of producing offspring. Since nature has pricked out the young man for the sexual pleasure of women and the production of offspring, let his love itself be the speaker's treasure, and let the use of that love, sexual intercourse, and the increase it might produce, be the treasure of women. Hence, though the poet's love of the young man is romantic and often passionate, it is almost certainly not homosexual. By contrast, the poems to the Dark Lady are explicitly, even graphically sexual at times, as in Sonnets 135 and 151. In Series 1, Chapter 11 on the Sonnets, I addressed the question whether or not Shakespeare was gay. A woman's face with nature's own hand painted, hast thou, the master, mistress of my passion? A woman's gentle heart, but not acquainted with shifting change, as is false women's fashion. An eye more bright than theirs, less false in rolling, gilding the object whereupon it gazeth. A man in hue, all hues in his controlling, which steals men's eyes and women's souls amazeth. And for a woman wert thou first created, till nature, as she wrought thee, fell a-doting, and by addition me of thee defeated, by adding one thing to my purpose nothing. But since she pricked thee out for women's pleasure, mine be thy love, and thy love's use their treasure. Sonnets 29 and 30. These two sonnets dramatize the transformation of mood inspired in the speaker by the thought of the beloved friend. Sonnet 29. When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy contented least. Yet in these thoughts, myself almost despising, haply I think on thee, and then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings, that then I scorn to change my state with kings. In this sonnet, the transformation is embodied in the shift from the series of end-stop lines, each a kind of sigh, to the elation expressed in the enjambment of lines 11 and 12, like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth. In line 1, when in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, the twofold disgrace refers to rejection by fortune. I discussed fortune in Session 1 of Chapter 7 in Series 1, and the disapproval of men. Bootless, in line 3 in the phrase bootless cries, means fruitless or useless. Wishing me like to one, in line 5, begins a list of 5 kinds of people who are better off, of which the first, more rich in hope, is the general category into which the next 4 fall, and means having a greater likelihood of future success. The second, featured like him, line 6, has better looks and other personal qualities. The third, like him with friends possessed, line 6, has supporters of various kinds and degrees. The fourth, this man's, line 7, has better art, meaning a focused gift for making some specific kind of valuable thing. The fifth, that man's, line 7, has scope, implying the capacity to be successful in a wide variety of arenas. Features and friends, line 6, in addition to being alliterative, make a contrast between that which one has in oneself and that which one has in others. Likewise, art and scope, line 7, are contrasting, art being narrow and focused, and scope being wide-reaching. Line 8, with what I most enjoy contented least, is a superb example of the unity of form and content. The 4 last words of the line, most enjoy contented least, form a chiasmus, a mirror image structure, with 2 verbs in the center, enjoy and contented, flanked by their respective antithetical modifiers, most and least. But even as that balance is struck, most enjoy, contented, least, the content of the words forms a series of 3 against 1, and also 6 against 1. 3 positive words, most, enjoy, contented, followed by a word that overturns these positives and transforms them into negatives, least, so that the last word entirely reverses the effect of the previous 3 words, and thereby also of the previous 6 words, with what I most enjoy contented, least. The phrase expresses just how one feels when, depressed and frustrated, one turns to the one activity sure to console or please, and that too turns to dust in the moment. Pick a day when everything has gone wrong, at school or at work, with friends, with your beloved, with your parents or your children, with your prospects, and you sit down to play the guitar to console yourself in your misery. If then the strings won't be tuned, and your fingers won't do what you tell them, your last hope for uplift is dashed. The thing that you most enjoyed now contents you least. Line 9, yet in these thoughts, promises to be a volta, a turning point, with the word yet. But instead, the word leads to the lowest point in the poem, myself almost despising. The real turning point comes with haply I think on thee, line 10. Haply means perhaps, by chance, though it puns on happily. The sound of the word thee, which picks up the assonance from beweep, me, featured, least, these, and the y in haply, and sends it on toward the word sweet in line 13, changes everything. The lark in line 11, like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth, refers to the European skylark, which rises into the sky at dawn too high to be seen, but can be heard singing its beautiful melody. It reappears in Shelley's poem, To a Skylark. In line 3, heaven is deaf, but in line 12, the speaker's state is, like the lark, singing hymns at heaven's gate. State means both state of mind and condition in the world, as in line 2, and hymns makes a pun on him, H-I-M, the beloved. Repeating the word state, the couplet asserts that the speaker would not change, that is, exchange, his state now even with kings, who represent possession of all that the speaker lacks in the first 8 lines. Kings are smiled on by fortune and men, They are able to command all that gives one richness of hope, features, friends, art, and scope. Such is the power of the love remembered. When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy contented least. Yet in these thoughts, myself almost despising, haply I think on thee, and then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings, that then I scorn to change my state with kings. Sonnet 30 makes a similar transformation, this time from memories of previous woes, but not until the last line. When to the sessions of sweet silent thought I summon up remembrance of things past, I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought, and with old woes new wail my dear time's waste. Then can I drown an eye unused to flow for precious friends hid in death's dateless night, and weep afresh love's long since cancelled woe, and moan the expense of many a vanished sight. Then can I grieve at grievances foregone, and heavily from woe to woe tell o'er the sad account of forebemoaned moan, which I knew pay as if not paid before. But if the while I think on thee, dear friend, all losses are restored and sorrows end. The sonnet begins with two law court metaphors, sessions, line 1, and summon, line 2. Into the court of memory are summoned lack, old woes, time's waste, dead friends, lost love, many a vanished sight, and old grievances. The poet repeats the sounds of woe through the poem by associating long O's, W's, S's, and O-R's with words implying sorrow. Woes, wail, waste, drown, flow, weep, woe, again, moan, foregone, woe, twice more, or, for bemoaned, moan, and before. 12 lines of old miseries recalled and recounted over and over in similar sounds. Tell and account are accounting metaphors. Bank clerks are called tellers because they tell, meaning count, cash. In contrast to those sounds, the word thee in line 13, but if the while I think on thee, dear friend, which is assonant with the long E of sweet in line 1, makes a total reversal in sound and feeling. In the final line, the poet joins all the sounds of woe into the words restored and sorrows, and then puts an end to them with the word end. Unlike the words of sorrow and woe, in which that long O can be drawn out endlessly, the pronunciation of the word end must actually end on the D. And what does the word end rhyme with? The word friend. The thought of the friend equals the end of the sorrows. Thus the form of the words and their senses become a single experience of love, the redeemer of moods. When to the sessions of sweet silent thought I summon up remembrance of things past, I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought, and with old woes new wail my dear time's waste. Then can I drown an eye unused to flow for precious friends hid in death's dateless night, and weep afresh love's long since cancelled woe, and moan the expense of many a vanished sight. then can I grieve at grievances foregone, and heavily from woe to woe tell o'er the sad account of fore bemoaned moan, which I knew pay as if not paid before. But if the while I think on thee, dear friend, all losses are restored, and sorrows end. Sonnet 42. That thou hast her, it is not all my grief, and yet it may be said I loved her dearly. That she hath thee is of my wailing chief, a loss in love that touches me more nearly. Loving offenders, thus I will excuse ye. Thou dost love her because thou knowest I love her, and for my sake even so doth she abuse me, suffering my friend for my sake to approve her. If I lose thee, my loss is my love's gain, and losing her, my friend hath found that loss. Both find each other, and I lose both twain, and both for my sake lay on me this cross. But here's the joy. My friend and I are one. Sweet flattery, then she loves but me alone. This sonnet also involves a reversal in the couplet. The three quatrains express the speaker's frustration with the suspicion that the beloved friend and the dark lady girlfriend are having an affair. He is jealous of the friend over the girlfriend, and even more jealous of the girlfriend over the friend. The reversal comes with the assertion that since he and his friend are one, the girlfriend loves only him after all. The reversal is embodied in the alteration of sounds as well as the sense. All those long E's in lines 1 through 5 and 7 turning into the O-N-E sounds at the end. The unity of the friends outweighs and at the same time redeems the love relationship with the girlfriend. She loves but me alone, line 14, abolishes not only any distance between the speaker and his friend, but also any betrayal by either the friend or the girlfriend. One may wonder whether such an apparently satisfactory emotional resolution is actually possible to one who loves two people in these two ways. The poet challenges all previous categories of friendship, love, and jealousy, and asserts an ideal unimaginable until we have read this poem, which makes it irresistibly real. That thou hast her, it is not all my grief, and yet it may be said I loved her dearly. That she hath thee is of my wailing chief, a loss in love that touches me more nearly. Loving offenders, thus I will excuse ye. Thou dost love her because thou knowest I love her, and for my sake even so doth she abuse me, suffering my friend for my sake to approve her. If I lose thee, my loss is my love's gain, and losing her, my friend hath found that loss. Both find each other, and I lose both twain, and both for my sake lay on me this cross. But here's the joy. My friend and I are one. Sweet flattery, then she loves but me alone. Sonnet 55. Not marble nor the gilded monuments of princes shall outlive this powerful rhyme, but you shall shine more bright in these contents than unswept stone besmeared with sluttish time. When wasteful war shall statues overturn, and broils root out the work of masonry, nor Mars his sword, nor war's quick fire shall burn the living record of your memory. Gainst death and all oblivious enmity shall you pace forth. Your praise shall still find room, even in the eyes of all posterity that wear this world out to the ending doom. So till the judgment that yourself arise, you live in this and dwell in lovers' eyes. Like Sonnet 18, Sonnet 55 seeks to immortalize the beloved, here by presenting itself as a surer way of doing so than any physical monument can provide. One of the marvels of this sonnet is again the use of sound to convey and reinforce sense. The first two lines, "Not marble nor the gilded monuments of princes shall outlive this powerful rhyme," make a strong contrast between the last word of line two, rhyme, and all the previous words. The series, "marble, gilded, monuments, princes, and powerful," repeat L, M, N, R consonants, the repetition is called consonance, and O, A, U, and short I vowels, that repetition is called assonance, to build up a sense of gravity, weighty monumentality, that is then exploded by the contrasting long I sound of the word rhyme. This sudden contrast is assisted by the fact that all that monumentality is introduced by the negating words not and nor in line one. The next two lines pick up the long I of rhyme, line two, in the words shine and bright, adding the sharp T in bright and contents, to make again a contrast with the mushy, slushy sounds of line four. Unswept stone besmeared with sluttish. With stone picking up the long O and the N of lines 1 and 2, again negating the value of physical monumentality, and time dissolving the hard T of line 3 in the M of lines 1 and 2. The result is a four-line chiasmic series which A. expresses the smearing of monuments in time, and B. expresses the sharp brightness of the beloved preserved in the poem. By chiasmic, I mean making the figure of speech called chiasmus, which you may remember from Session 3 of Chapter 4 on Language in Series 1, or from the discussion of Richard II in Podcast Q in Series 2. The chiasmus is an ABBA, or mirror image structure. So here, A, "Not marble nor the gilded monuments of princes shall outlive this powerful," B, rhyme, B, "But you shall shine more bright in these contents," A, "Than unswept stone besmeared with sluttish time." Line four creates in sound the equivalent of the smudging of lettering that time works upon stone, making a smeary fuzziness of sound corresponding to the smeary fuzziness of sight, and contrasting with it the sounds of rhyme and bright that represent the ever-crisp and clear effect of the poem and of the beloved in it. In line 9, "'Gainst death and all oblivious enmity," the added unstressed or perhaps elided syllable on the second I in the word oblivious contrasts with the two spondees that begin line 10, "shall you pace forth." Against the smudging, smearing oblivion, felt in the four short vowels in oblivious, which the enmity of time works upon physical monuments, and consequently upon the memory of those recorded on them, we have "shall you pace forth," the stride of those four equally stressed syllables, two spondees, reinforcing the meaning of the word pace. And the two spondees are followed by 2.5 lines whose enjambment makes the reader of the poem run almost out of breath by the last word, doom, which itself can be drawn out till the breath is gone. "Your praise shall still find room, even in the eyes of all posterity that wear this world out to the ending doom." Still means always, as usual in Shakespeare. So we have the beloved pacing forth through the long declining history of the world to its end, represented in the long declining breath of the reader of the lines. There is no substitute for reading this poem aloud. See how you do in saying these 2.5 and jammed lines without any punctuation to give you pause for breath. Ending doom and judgment refer to the end of the world on the day of the last judgment, when, according to Christian doctrine, all the dead will be resurrected and judged by God. The final contrast of the poem, giving sound to the contrast between the wearing out of the world until doomsday and the perpetual living and shining of the beloved, is that between the M and long O sounds that pick up the sounds of the first two lines, and the long I of arise and eyes that pick up the sound of rhyme in line two. Until doomsday, then, the beloved will live in this, the poem itself that we are reading, living in the eyes of its readers, who are lovers of their own beloveds, and, reading the poem, become lovers of the speaker's beloved too. Not marble nor the gilded monuments of princes shall outlive this powerful rhyme, but you shall shine more bright in these contents than unswept stone be smeared with sluttish time. When wasteful war shall statues overturn, and broils root out the work of masonry, nor Mars his sword, nor war's quick fire, shall burn the living record of your memory. 'Gainst death and all oblivious enmity shall you pace forth. Your praise shall still find room even in the eyes of all posterity that wear this world out to the ending doom. So till the judgment that yourself arise, you live in this and dwell in lovers' eyes. Sonnet 60. Like as the waves make towards the pebbled shore, so do our minutes hasten to their end, each changing place with that which goes before. In sequent toil all forwards do contend. Nativity, once in the main of light, crawls to maturity, wherewith being crowned, crooked eclipses 'gainst his glory fight, and time that gave doth now his gift confound. Time doth transfix the flourish set on youth, and delves the parallels in beauty's brow, feeds on the rarities of nature's truth, and nothing stands but for his scythe to mow. And yet to times in hope my verse shall stand, praising thy worth despite his cruel hand. In Sonnet 60, as in Sonnets 18 and 55, the poem itself becomes the vehicle of the beloved's survival in the face of the passage of time that slowly but surely eats away at every beauty. Line 1 begins with two trochees alternating with iambs to give a sense of forward motion, like as the waves make towards the pebbled shore. Then line 2 and line 3 each begins with a troche followed by all iambs. So do our min, each changing place. The troches feel as if they are trying to slow or stop our motion forward, putting the weight of the stresses early. But the force of time, and of meter in the verse, drives us forward to the end of the line as waves follow one after another to the shore, and as time drives us forward toward our ends. The trochees in lines 1 to 3 cannot stop the forward motion of the meter, and line 4, in sequent toil all forwards do contend, is all regular iambic feet, punctuating the irresistible forward motion of time. The same contrast happens in the second quatrain. The trochees are once in, line 5, crawls to, and possibly wherewith, in line 6, and crooked, in line 7. By line 8, and time that gave doth now his gift confound, we are back in irresistibly regular iambic rhythm again. The same happens with the troche feeds on in line 11, followed by the regularly iambic line 12, and nothing stands but for his scythe to mow. The parallels in beauty's brow of line 10 refer to wrinkle lines in the forehead. The couplet reverses the relation, giving us a regular iambic line 13, and yet to times in hope my verse shall stand, and beginning line 14 with a troche, praising. By contrasting it with Troches, the poem sets up the iambic as the forward motion of time, and then it uses the contrast of troche and iamb to place the beloved outside time's sequent toil. Like as the waves make towards the pebbled shore, so do our minutes hasten to their end. Each changing place with that which goes before, in sequent toil all forwards do contend. Nativity, once in the main of light, crawls to maturity, wherewith being crowned, crooked eclipses gainst his glory fight, and time that gave doth now his gift confound. Time doth transfix the flourish set on youth, and delves the parallels in beauty's brow, feeds on the rarities of nature's truth, and nothing stands but for his scythe to mow. And yet to times in hope my verse shall stand, praising thy worth despite his cruel hand. Sonnet 65. Since brass, nor stone, nor earth, nor boundless sea, but sad mortality o'ersways their power, how with this rage shall beauty hold a plea, whose action is no stronger than a flower? Oh, how shall summer's honey breath hold out against the wreckful siege of battering days, when rocks impregnable are not so stout, nor gates of steel so strong, but time decays? O fearful meditation, where, alack, shall time's best jewel from time's chest lie hid? Or what strong hand can hold his swift foot back? Or who his spoil of beauty can forbid? O none, unless this miracle have might, that in black ink my love may still shine bright. Sonnet 65 similarly makes black ink, line 14, the miracle that has the might, line 13, to forbid the spoil of beauty by time, line 12. The power of mortality that o'ersways the power, line 2, even of brass, stone, earth, and boundless sea, line 1, is contrasted with the weakness of the rhyming word flower, line 4. The battering of the hard consonants in rackful, battering, rocks, stout, gates, steel, and strong, lines 6 through 8, is contrasted with the drawn-out sound of decays in line 8, so that all strengths and hardnesses are finally eroded in sound as in sense. Against this decay of the vowels and consonants in the first 12 lines of the poem stands the crisp, vowel-consonant combination in might and bright, which reverses the order of sound in the word time, from T-I to I-T-E. Time, might, bright. And makes the miracle of the poem overrule with it, the decaying power contained in the tie of time. Since brass nor stone nor earth nor boundless sea, but sad mortality o'ersways their power, how with this rage shall beauty hold a plea, whose action is no stronger than a flower? Oh, how shall summer's honey breath hold out against the wreckful siege of battering days, when rocks impregnable are not so stout, nor gates of steel so strong, but time decays? O fearful meditation, where, alack, shall time's best jewel from time's chest lie hid? Or what strong hand can hold his swift foot back? Or who his spoil of beauty can forbid? O none, unless this miracle have might, that in black ink my love may still shine bright. I am Dr. Rapp, and this is Appreciating Shakespeare.